Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. The power of digital computing is astounding. Tubes and consoles, which used to take up entire floors or rooms in buildings in the 1950s, now fit into the palm of our hand. Computers have changed the way we work, think, perform, create, interact, and archive. It's hard to think of a transaction in our personal or professional lives that doesn't involve some interface with a computer. Certainly this is true in healthcare, where the last decade has seen the profession move from the pre-digital era to one in which nearly 90% of doctors now use electronic health records to record patient information and help with decision-making. The promise of Watson, IBM's smart, self-learning supercomputer, holds enormous promise for medical practice in making diagnoses and offering the most appropriate therapies. How do we make sense of this landscape whose only constant seems to be change? My guest today, William Paiva, sits right at the junction of healthcare, business, and information technology. The center he's built at Oklahoma State University, called the Center for Health Systems Innovation, sits between OSU's Business School and College of Health Sciences. Started 3 years ago with a philanthropic gift and an idea, Paiva has built the center into a juggernaut, now with more than 30 full-time employees working on using technology to address rural and Native American health challenges in Oklahoma. William Paiva, Executive Director of OSU's Center for Health Systems Innovation, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa, Medical Monday. William Paiva, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start just by having you describe the mission of the Center for Health Systems Innovation. What are the goals you're trying to accomplish there?
Yeah, thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. I'm honored to be here, and I'm actually excited to tell your listeners about what I consider to be a really exciting center we have at Oklahoma State University. The center is about 3 years old. It was created after a donation from one of OSU's alums, Neil Patterson. Neil was the founder, chairman, and CEO, and he's actually still the founding chairman and CEO of Cerner Corporation, the large electronic medical record company in Kansas City. And he donated money to create an endowment that funds our operations, as well as he donated a large data set. Now, when we started, we really had a white sheet of paper to go pick where we wanted to focus on in healthcare. And if you've paid attention to everything going on in healthcare, there's obviously lots of areas to focus on for health innovation. We specifically chose rural health, and we did that for a very specific purpose. If you look at rural healthcare, first off, healthcare across the entire United States has significant challenges, and I'm not telling you anything that you don't know. You know, we continue to have shortages in healthcare throughout our system, whether it's primary care or even subspecialists throughout our entire healthcare system. And our patient populations continue to struggle with healthcare issues, whether it be hypertension, diabetes, depression, mental health, tobacco use, whatever it is. If you look at the rural markets, those issues tend to be a little bit more significant than we have in the urban settings. The rural patient populations can tend to have higher rates of diabetes, tobacco use, hypertension rates compared to the urban counterparts. And that creates a much more strenuous demand on the rural healthcare system. But if you look at the delivery side, if you look at the number of primary care docs that are, we have a shortage in Oklahoma, the primary care coverage in rural America and rural Oklahoma is significantly less than it should be. So you have a supply and demand problem throughout the healthcare system, but in the rural markets, it's especially acute because the patients have generally more significant health issues, and the providers are even more scarce in the rural markets than in urban markets. So we purposely picked the rural market because it's such a big demand, such a big problem. And as a former venture capitalist, you know, I spent 15 years investing in health innovation companies, and everybody's focused on urban innovation for obvious reasons. There's a million people in Oklahoma City's MSA and in Tulsa's MSA, and if you win those markets, it's a big win. And so everybody focuses in urban innovation. So because of the need and the lack of innovation in rural markets, and then fundamentally, Oklahoma is a rural state. Oklahoma State University is a land-grant university, and the medical school is really designed to strategically graduate healthcare providers to practice in rural medicine. For all those reasons, both supply and demand and need in alignment with OSU's strategic mission, we decided to focus specifically in rural healthcare.
So, I mean, that is very logical and makes a lot of sense and addresses a great problem, as you point out, I mean, where there's an increased need and probably greater need in the rural community just on a per capita basis. So one thing that's interesting, though, is your center. You're more than a data shop. You're an innovation hub, if you will, and you're not necessarily producing the healthcare practitioners that are going to go into this space, but it's really using technology to address some of these shortages, right? So can you describe, I mean, what are some ways?
Yeah, absolutely. And you've picked on the exact niche because I just articulated the big need. If you look at our medical school, they're really trying to figure out ways to, how do we graduate more providers and get them into rural markets? So that's one of your arrows in a quiver, right, to fix the problem. There's other people that are focused on licensure issues and how do we get people to practice at the top of their license, as we hear people talk about, and that's a very political issue on this license issue. Yeah. But there are people that are focused
on the listeners, that means going, because there's a shortage of doctors, it's increasing because there's more access for nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and increasing their scope of practices so that they can help address some of the shortage.
Absolutely, yeah. So it fills that void by allowing people to practice above what they would normally do, let's say, in an urban market. Absolutely. But the niche we are focused on is how do we add two things. One is looking at the existing care that's being delivered in the rural markets. And for all the constraints or issues I previously articulated, how do we actually find workflow efficiencies and delivery models that are better suited to rural markets so we get more out of less just through the workflow efficiencies and rural care delivery innovation models? So that's one part of our center. And then the other part of the center is looking at how do we add technology layers into rural healthcare to try to get more out of our providers in the rural market. So we really have kind of two focus areas. One is looking at how do we improve the delivery in the rural markets by workflow efficiencies and new care delivery models in that environment. And then the others, and I talk about them separately, but they're obviously linked, about how do we bring technology layers, whether it be mobile health, you know, telehealth, predictive models using analytics, all the number different types of technology layers in healthcare.
So that's a big topic, and let's come back to that. But for a second, how do you streamline the delivery? Like what are ways in which you can help improve? And that, is that, you said they're kind of interwoven, so it's mm-hmm. You may be talking about a similar aspect. I mean, using mobile or telemedicine, this is the idea of interacting with your healthcare provider or your doctor on the video screen or
let me give you a very real example. So we went out very early in the initiation of the center about 3 years ago. We went out and surveyed about 35 rural clinics throughout Oklahoma and about 250 rural providers. And we basically took them through a structured Q&A, if you will. We had a series of questions. We mapped their practices. We looked at their patient flow. We looked at their patient mix. We looked at all these things. And at the end of that, we went through a whole host of analytics and analyzed all that data. And it turns out, and the basic thing we were looking at was to say, what are your major impediments to effective delivery of care in a rural market? And the three major areas that popped up, number one, at the highest, was everything related to scheduling, logistics, and transportation in a rural marketplace. So people getting to their appointments, making their appointments. So everything around that wrapper of scheduling, logistics, and transportation. The second is everything related to pharmacy issues. So pharmacy pre-authorization, local pharmacy inventory levels, et cetera, were the second most common issue dealing with the effective workflow of the rural clinic. And the last one was isolation. Many rural providers felt isolated really in two different areas. A clinical isolation, they feel isolated from the broader healthcare system because they're practicing sometimes in rural markets that are isolated. And then even an IT isolation. They're not connected to the internet well. Their EMRs are not connected, or electronic medical record systems are not connected well to the system. So those were the three major impediments we discovered around workflow or delivery of healthcare. So for each one of those, we have very specific targeted innovations that have already been developed and are being tested. In the first, scheduling, logistics, and transportation, we have a couple of demonstration projects we have ongoing in that category. Everything related to the pharmacy pre-authorization, pharmacy local inventory levels to try to deal with that issue, secondly. So for each one of those are some of the, when you talk about care delivery and workflow in the rural markets, issues that affect urban healthcare delivery are sometimes different in rural markets and vice versa, just because of the nature of the industry. Let me give you a specific example around pharmacy, for instance. A lot of our doctors in urban markets have pretty advanced electronic medical record systems. So if you as a physician prescribe a patient to take a cholesterol-lowering drug and you haven't yet done their lipid panel or their blood test to prescribe that meds, it'll usually flag in the EMR system that this is going to get rejected at the pharmacy because there's no record of a proper lab being conducted. But in the electronic medical record system in a rural market, which may not be as robust, The drug is ordered, patient goes to the pharmacy, it gets rejected there, they come back to the doctor's office, they got to get the proof of the lab, they got to go back to the pharmacy to get it prescribed and show actual authorization they should get that or that they called the pharmacy. So those kinds of things that we sometimes in urban markets lose sight of what the challenges are for rural healthcare delivery, because we assume all our issues here are the same ones there, just the market's not as dense there. But the challenges are different there.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is William Paiva. He's Executive Director of OSU's Center for Health Systems Innovation. And we're talking about their mission to help with delivery of healthcare in rural areas using technology as a key driver of that. And so you looked at when you did your sort of your fact finding, you found that there were issues that you addressed around transportation and logistics and scheduling and pharmacy. But in addition, you were looking at other ways of trying to bring essentially more care through using technology platforms. What are some examples of those?
Yeah, I'll give you a couple of very real examples of, if we'll shift gears to the other side of the house that's doing pretty heavy technology type innovations. So what we did is we went out and we looked at some of the major illnesses or diagnoses that are affecting our rural populations. And obviously some of the ones that come to the top are diabetes is a significant issue in rural markets, congestive heart failure, hypertension. These are some of the major things. So we went through and we looked at all the major diagnoses affecting rural markets. And then within each one of them, we kind of bored into them and tried to pick specific ones where we thought we could actually make a meaningful impact in the management of a component of those diseases. You got to be very focused in healthcare because you can't boil the ocean, right? And so you got to, you know, you can't fix everything in rural healthcare. I mean, we can't fix everything in healthcare, period. So you got to be very laser focused. So we specifically went through this analysis, and I won't bore you with the entire analysis, but we ended up focusing initially on a complication with diabetic patients, okay? It's called diabetic retinopathy. If you're a diabetic patient, and if you live long enough with diabetes, you'll eventually go blind because of diabetes. It's the number one cause of blindness. It's very unfortunate because there are very clear protocols about management of diabetic retinopathy. And if you do have diabetic retinopathy, there's an almost 100% effective therapy called the laser if we catch you early enough, which can halt the disease progression, but it can't reverse it, right? So if I can find these patients early enough, I can actually get them a 100% effective to halt the disease progression. The challenge is in America, only about one-third of the diabetic patients actually go get their annual eye exam by an ophthalmologist. So they go to the primary care physician. The primary care physician tells them, you need to go get your annual eye exam. Unfortunately, only about one-third of them nationally will go get their annual eye exam, largely because it's a disease that's what we call asymptomatic, where you don't have any symptoms. So most diabetics say, I see fine, so they don't go to the ophthalmologist. Now, in the rural markets, it's especially challenging because you tell a rural diabetic patient he's getting an eye exam. There is no diabetic there is generally not an ophthalmologist in rural Oklahoma to even get it done if they wanted to. And then for most of them are hourly employees. For them to come to Tulsa or Oklahoma City to actually get their annual eye exam, it might cost them between transportation costs, lost wages, because usually they're hourly employees, and medical costs incurred, it could be $250 to $300 to go get an annual eye exam at an ophthalmologist in Tulsa and Oklahoma City, even if they can get in.
Right. So huge barriers.
Huge issue. So what we decided, but we did know, is that they actually go to their primary care doc with a very high percentage. So almost every one of them will go to their primary care doc for their annual checkup. So we decided to see, out of their existing data that would normally be collected in a normal primary care visit, and that would be their demographic information, any comorbidities or other diseases they might have, and their basic lab data that gets collected in a normal blood work. Could we, out of that data, be able to predict whether or not they have diabetic retinopathy out of that very simple collection of data?
So without having to look at their eye, just use the data that's already collected to try to predict using some kind of analytics or predictive model.
Yeah.
So how well does that work?
Well, if you believe our data, we're right now at over 95% sensitivity and specificity that we think we can predict diabetic retinopathy out of their existing lab data without them needing to go to an ophthalmologist. Now, we need to do the prospective clinical validation of it, which we're in the middle of doing right now, to map the predictive model to the gold standard, which is the ophthalmologist looking in an eye. Now, if we're right, this is a very classic example of how we can use this new field of digital health data or predictive medicine to actually be able to predict people's diseases out of their lab data or their existing data that's being collected in a brand new industry called predictive medicine. And that's what we're really excited about on the other side of our shop, which is focused on how do we actually take all this health data that we have out there and we're collecting now and develop tools to, once again, it all goes back to our core mission, which is rural healthcare. Because if I can do that, I can now give a rural primary care doc a tool to manage diabetic patients because he has no ophthalmologist there locally to do it.
That is a really interesting example because, again, you have that issue of, you mentioned, you know, the barrier, which is the transportation, the logistics, the cost. But if you are able to predict, I mean, this is my conclusion of this, if you're able to predict who's going to have the retinopathy, you're going to red flag that patient or tell that patient, like, you've really got to get to the eye doctor because if you don't, you're the one who's going to go blind sooner rather than later. So that's a very powerful thing if that bears out.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. It's subject to a prospective clinical validation, which we're doing currently. But you're exactly right, John, which is right now all they do is they tell their diabetic patient, you need to go get your annual eye exam because you might have it, right? And most patients are like, I see fine.
Right.
Now, if we run the algorithm on it, which is non-invasive, it doesn't take, the patient really is, it's a normal visit. It's just taking their existing data and running it on top of it. Now the physician can tell a patient, based on this algorithm, it looks like you have diabetic retinopathy. And if you don't go to an ophthalmologist to have them check it out and confirm it, and if confirmed, you get the laser, probably next year you'll see vision erosion. Well, that's a much more powerful statement that a doctor can make to his patient than go to an ophthalmologist because you might, or you really should go to an ophthalmologist because it looks like you do have this.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So you mentioned that phrase big data, and that's something that comes up a lot. And I've interviewed authors on the show that have written about genomic data, trying to make sense of this incredible data we have. Now, you put on a conference, your center put on a conference here, both in Tulsa and Oklahoma City, and you had a gentleman from IBM who actually is the medical director of the Watson computer project. Now, we know Watson famously from Jeopardy when it destroyed the human contestants, including Ken Jennings. What are some ways in which Watson is helpful in healthcare, both, I think, diagnosis and treatment already, or what do you see for the future, or what did that doctor tell your audience?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big promise of platforms like IBM Watson, and those are really all under this category of cognitive computing or artificial intelligence or machine learning, is that the hope for that whole category, because a lot of stuff we do is just to take static data sets and use traditional analytic tools on it, to regression models or these kind of statistical things that we do with the data. But these kind of more advanced systems like IBM Watson, which are kind of these self-learning systems that are able to process data at a rate in disparate data at a rate that, quite honestly, is far superior than what humans can do. And I know that sounds like a shocking statement, because as a society, we're sitting there going, now, wait a minute, you're telling me computers can outthink humans? And you're going to have a whole discussion on that very topic. But this whole category of computers, the goal is that they're able to process information at a rate and disparate information, data that's completely unrelated to one another, and process it in a way to predict, in the case of IBM Watson and Jeopardy, to predict answers to trivia questions. In the case of a patient in front of you, you could potentially envision a day in the future where you have IBM Watson-like platforms sitting in the hospitals, and you're in a significant emergency situation in the ER, and there's data coming from everywhere about this patient, you know, their blood pressure, their respiratory rate, their lab data, and all this. And, you know, right now, doctors have to make sense of all this data, and some of it is confusing and in conflict with each other, because one data point may say it's this way, but the other date says it's not, and you're sort of trying to process all this. And so the big promise of that whole category is that as computers continue to evolve, as computers continue to get faster and faster, can we use those platforms to ingest data and process it at a rate potentially even far greater and faster than maybe even humans can do for many industries? It's not just healthcare. It could be many, many industries. It's a really exciting time for that whole category.
Did you get a sense from that chat that Watson is sort of ready for prime time, or is out there in the medical marketplace, or is it still more in the laboratory kind of validation phase, like they're trying to really figure out applicable ways to use it?
The former rather than the latter. I mean, I think it's far easier to answer trivia questions at a IBM Watson Jeopardy event, and that's really interesting to watch. it's far different to take that platform and then apply it to a complicated medical situation. It's still in the very infancy right now. But, you know, I think that's probably where we're heading for a lot of these things. I mean, if you look at some of the industries where those types of platforms have eliminated, for instance, humans out of trading, I mean, I think like 90% of trading is accomplished right now, if not more, with actually computer systems automatically trading foreign currencies, equities, et cetera. And the whole days of a room full of brokers issuing trades and that kind of stuff, I think, is going away, if not completely gone away. So I think a lot of these industries are heading down that path.
My guest today is William Paiva. He is the executive director of the Oklahoma State University Center for Health Systems Innovation, which has a mission of improving rural healthcare delivery in Oklahoma. And also, I looked on the website on the mission statement, also Native American health as well, right?
That's correct.
Is that tied in with rural, like, or is it specifically looking at Native populations?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
There's a high degree of overlap between Native American health and rural health. And so there's a lot of similarities between the management of Native American health issues and the management of rural, just because of geographic, because there's a lot of overlap. But there's also some nuances of Native American patient populations compared to other patient populations. And that's true of all patient populations, whether it's Native Americans or Hispanics or Native Americans or Caucasians. We all have our own uniqueness around us. So the answer to your question is yes and yes.
I think your story is an interesting one because you explain medical concepts really well, but your background is actually not in medicine per se, but you have a PhD in molecular biology. So did you work in laboratories early on, or did you kind of quickly after you got your degree go, because you did some time as a consultant, and as you said, you spent several years in industry and then venture capital. How did that all come about?
Yeah, I get that question a lot. So I started my career initially under the intent of being a scientist. Got an undergraduate and graduate degrees at the University of Oklahoma, and actually did my research at the Oklahoma Medical Research Foundation, which is in Oklahoma City, which is a not-for-profit research institution. And then also did my postdoctoral fellowship there as well in neurobiology and cell biology. And then just decided I really wanted to get on the business side of science. I didn't want to leave science because I never feel like I've left science, as you articulated. I just wanted to get on the business side of science. And so I just made the decision to go get an MBA, a master's in business administration, and I did that back east and got an MBA. And then for really about 20 years, worked at J.P. Morgan in investment banking and healthcare, worked at Merck in business development in New Jersey, worked in venture capital for 15 or 16 years. And so even though I went and got a business degree, everything I've always done has been focused on healthcare innovation, entrepreneurship, finance, et cetera. And then took this position over 3 years ago and have loved it. Absolutely been. It's been a very personally rewarding, maybe one of my most personally rewarding experiences and even professionally rewarding experiences to build something, because it really started with just an idea and an endowment and data set. And we've built what we think is a pretty innovative center that is really exciting.
Right. So in those 3 years, you've gone from essentially, as you said, yourself kind of an endowment and a blank piece of paper to, I mean, how many employees do you have?
We have currently 31
Wow.
full-time employees that are dedicated to this center. And then we have probably about 10 graduate students that are working in one of our areas that I've talked about in health innovation, either for their master's thesis or their PhD dissertation. And we even have a postdoctoral fellow that's doing a postdoctoral fellow with us. It's been really a lot of fun. And I think it really speaks to a couple of things. I think it speaks to the need we hit on, because we hit on a niche here that has really been untapped. I actually describe rural healthcare. There are 386 MSAs in the country, MSA being a metropolitan service area. And so Tulsa's an MSA, Oklahoma City's an MSA, Fort Smith's an MSA. So there are 386 defined metropolitan service areas in the country. I define rural as America's 387th MSA.
Because it, in terms of size, it all adds up to...
And it has 60 million people in it.
Oh, that's a huge MSA.
So
oh.
I tell people it's the forgotten 387th MSA with 60 million people in it. And to a certain extent, those same people, I think, felt forgotten in the last election. Don't want to get into politics in this
right.
discussion. But it's an area of healthcare that people talk a lot about. But because of the nature and the dynamics of the markets, there's not a whole lot of people focusing on innovation in those markets because financially, as a former entrepreneur, venture capitalist, et cetera, you go after the big markets and that's where the money is. And so I think it speaks to the fact that we've hit on a niche on rural healthcare and a real untapped need there or an unmet need there. And then the second is this whole area of predictive medicine and data analytics and how do we take, because we all have been to doctors now and we go to the doctor and they've got a laptop or an iPad or a device, whereas 10 years ago they had a chart out and they wrote it out in paper.
That's right.
Now it's all runs through a computer and because of that, it's now sitting in a digital format somewhere. Well, that is the first time this industry has been able to take digital data or have their data in a digital format to actually start doing some of the things like I talked about on the diabetic retinopathy. Because when we built that model, John, we used 2.1 million diabetic patients in their ophthalmic information to build that model and all their lab data. Now, think about if you tried to build that model and tried to go through 2.1 million paper charts for a diabetic. It's impossible.
It would take a lifetime. You wouldn't be able to.
So that whole side of it also, I think, is really taking off. And I think it's because we hit the, you know, as I've learned in venture capital, timing is important. And you can be too early and you can be too late. And I think we've hit the timing right for both the focus areas in rural health and in predictive medicine. That's we've been able to attract a lot of attention both locally and even nationally.
One of the things that I was curious about when you talk about having had experience in venture capital, I mean, is it really sort of those relationships that have helped you in building your center? I mean, is it sort of a Rolodex effect? I mean, have you know people kind of all over the country who are on the leading edge of innovation and then financing these types of things?
Yeah, I think there's no question of that. Yeah, no, I think, like I said, it's been very personally rewarding and professionally rewarding for me to do this. But I think you've really hit on a very important point in that is reality, is a lot of these companies and universities that we are bringing to bear at this center are folks that for 20 years I dealt with in some form or fashion, either mm-hmm. in banking and entrepreneurship and venture capital, et cetera. And I would just say, look, you know, I'm running this new center. I think there's something really exciting here. And I think there's a way for us to work together because I know where you're going and I think there's an opportunity for us to collaborate. And so I think for sure that's happened.
So what do we look for in the future? So more in terms of predictive models using these large data sets, and the retinopathy example is an excellent one. Are there other disease conditions that your center is specifically looking at or that you could even talk about or new apps, new technology tools? What kinds of things should we look out for? Or if you could, you know, predict the future or the William Paiva vision of the healthcare future?
Yeah, no, thank you for it's a good question. And it's one that I ask myself all the time. My goal is to have this center at 100 people in the fifth year. And to do that, I've got some very specific things I want to focus on. So within the disease-specific questions you've asked, what I'd like to do is, if the diabetic retinopathy is correct, diabetic patients have many microvascular complications, so peripheral neuropathy, nephropathy, et cetera. So I'd like to take the same approach to every one of those. From a center and from a bigger perspective, I think there's lots of things we can do towards doing more around the analytics, focusing on labs, focusing on drug outcomes, because I can do that in my data. There's lots of areas I can go there. And then in the center perspective, we're not there yet, but if you look at the rural challenges, having done business around the world, the rural challenges we face in rural America and we face in rural Oklahoma are identical healthcare challenges that I saw in China, that are there in India. So a lot of applicability between some of our rural health challenges and international health challenges. Lack of primary care physicians, lack of subspecialists, lack of emergency medicine, lack of technology. Everything I just said is rural Oklahoma. It's also Beijing, China.
Been a pleasure talking to you. William Paiva is the executive director of OSU's Center for Health Systems Innovation, and he was our guest today on Studio Tulsa.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.